Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
President Bush continues to not let facts get in the way of his ideology.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Above Politics Show. I'm Martin Bain.
And I'm Omar Fyfe.
And hey, we have a packed show today. We have a commentary on the third presidential debate from one of our members. I'm sure that's something you and I will talk about. We also
Boring.
I know, but give us a minute. Let's tell them, the dear listeners, what else they've got to look forward to in this show. We have a UK roundup from Nevermore, and then we have an interview with a member of the Liberal Democrats in the United Kingdom. That's the third party from Paul.
Oh, that'd be great.
Well, I've got to say, it was one I worked hard to get, and that's with Paul Harrod, who's looking to be the Liberal MP for a constituency in the United Kingdom. So we have that towards the end of the show. And then I think there's a very, very special thing towards the very end of the show where our friend, our good friend, Omar Fyfe, is going to give you a rant. But we'll keep that to the almost the very end of the show.
Yes, and a fine rant it is, Martin.
It certainly is. So we have this commentary on the third presidential debate. Before we run with that, though, I certainly know you and I have had the opportunity to have a look at it, and I think your comments earlier on was it was boring. I suppose the other thing I'd have to say, it seemed to be fairly gaff-free as well.
And, you know, I think that's what people want too. It's a shame, but the vice presidential debate had to be the highlight of all the debates this year. But I think it was the only one that was something that people didn't expect. You know, I think that, like you say, the commentary on it is going to allude to the fact that it was very scripted and that no gaffes, nothing unexpected. But in a lot of ways, Martin, I think that's good. We got two presidential candidates in a time of economic crisis. I kind of like for them to be scripted. I don't want them coming out with something that's just going to completely knock our socks off when the economy's the way it is.
But I just wonder whether the style of this debate, I think they call it the town hall debate, where the two candidates have the ability to sort of walk around a little bit more. And some people, you know, were saying that may have suited Mr. McCain more, but I just think it was an interesting format, and I'm not sure how well that worked.
But, you know, Martin, people say it fits McCain better, and yet all anyone can talk about is Senator Obama's ability to speak. You would think that given that, he would do better at the town hall, and yet it seems he doesn't. It's kind of a quandary to me to watch these things.
One of the things I sort of heard and read on was, you know, everyone does polling, you know, straight away within minutes of the end of the debate. And one of the interesting things that I saw was that people who listened to the debate on radio seemed to think that McCain had done better, where there seemed to be, depending, of course, on which network or who did the debate or who did the polling, but it seems to be that the TV audience seemed to lean more to Barack Obama. So it was interesting. That, I think, was a very interesting thing, that if people don't see the candidates, they maybe get a totally different view.
Yeah, but I think too, Martin, that's just a product of the environment. Most of your radio listeners are going to be conservatives. Talk radio is huge. You have Rush Limbaugh with 22 million listeners, Sean Hannity 12 million, goes on down the line, where a lot of your television types are more liberal people who are going to lean more toward Obama. I think that's a fairly natural poll. That didn't surprise me.
But I just thought it was an interesting thing to bring to our members. So without further ado, let's have a listen to an ATS member called Don White on his views on the third presidential election.
Hello, I'm Don White. I'm on AboveTopSecret.com, and I'm going to offer some of my commentary on the number three debate that we've had here in America over the presidency. That debate was held, as you know, on October 7th at Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee. The next and last debate will come up on the 15th of October at Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. The third debate the second meeting, the vice presidential. The third debate was the town meeting format, which everyone had said earlier favored Mr. McCain. But after I watched the debate, I really couldn't sense that he had gained any advantage by using that particular format. The format allows the speaker to move around and face different parts of the audience as he feels like it's beneficial to his position. So they're not stuck in one spot. The next debate, they'll be sitting down. The first debate, they were standing behind a lectern. So they've tried to use three different formats to see what, if anyone is favored by one over the other. Basically, of course, neither candidate offered anything really new, I regret to say. The major issue that's come to America now is the economic issue, and of course there's still a lot of controversy about what to do to help it. We know that it's getting bad. The stock market, which is our measure of economic success, has fallen from 10,800 down to 8,200, which is a substantial decline over a two-week period. Many people say that it may fall yet further, so we don't know what's going to happen. It's a very complex situation. It cannot be undone easily, and of course, other countries are pointing their finger at us now, and I think that we do share the bulk of the blame, but I'm not going to get into that. The candidates were asked questions by the moderator, Tom Brokaw, who's a well-known newscaster in the United States and highly respected and regarded. But he, like all the other moderators, is under a limitation that even if he's aware that one of the candidates has misstated, either accidentally or intentionally, a fact. The moderators are not permitted to clarify that fact for the audience's benefit. So even if some people think the candidate's misstated, it just has to go by the board. The questions, unfortunately, are sometimes, in my opinion, somewhat mundane. They ask, for example, in one case, they recited the economy, health care, and the Iraq War, and asked the candidate to tell us which one they would give priority to. How they would prioritize those three issues. So the question didn't even ask whether or not they had a position on the issue. It just asked how they would prioritize. So I'm not terribly enthused about the productivity of our debate system. The debate watchers had said that McCain needed to do something dramatic in order to reverse his slide in the popularity poll. And according to the people who watched the debate and get paid for their opinions, he did not have anything dramatic to offer. So basically, the feeling was, amongst those I watched, the Democrat candidate continues to be ahead of the Republican candidate and may even be adding somewhat to his very small lead. The one of the polls that we use here, the Gallup poll, is done weekly, and the last time it was done, it showed that Obama was ahead nationwide of 6 percentage points, keeping in mind that the poll itself says that there's a 3-point margin of error. This is the first time the poll has revealed the Democratic candidate to be ahead by an amount greater than the margin of error. So I think the sum of this third debate would be that it was not rewarding to the listener, that we didn't gain any additional information about what a candidate would do. Both candidates avoided dealing with the economic situation, and I can understand that because, frankly, no one knows what to do. And so a candidate doesn't want to stick his nose out his head in a noose offering to do something, and then by the time we come back for the next debate seeing that was wrong. So really it's asking too much of the candidates when even the experts don't know what's going on. So that's my opinion of the third debate. It was well handled. The candidates were polite, civil toward each other, and the audience was responsive, but we really just repeated everything we'd already heard. So that's my report.
Well, now that was an outstanding commentary on the debate. Don White sure is an eloquent individual. I think that one of the comments, though, that people are looking for is, are we going to see anything new between now and November? And I think we are, but I think what we're seeing here is a unique phenomenon. Everything new that we're seeing and all of the dirt that's being dug up and thrown around by these two candidates is being thrown around by everyone except them. I'm seeing the candidates as remaining professional and above board, and yet their individual parties are digging up dirt and just throwing it around like nobody's business. And I think that's unique to this election. So between now and November, we're going to see something new. I just don't think it's going to be from the candidates themselves.
And let's face it, you know, what would we expect to come new from either of the candidates? You know, they've been sort of doing this for a good 18 to 20 months. So, you know, if we suddenly heard something new from either candidate, I'm not sure whether that would be seen as a good or a bad thing. I'm sure there are some people who would applaud it and say, here's a candidate thinking out of the box. But I think a lot of people would turn around and say, whoa, do I want the man who's going to be president of the United States just coming out with something, you know, curveballing me maybe a few weeks before election?
I think that's it exactly. I think that they have been vetted so completely with what is being termed as the longest political runoff in history. I mean, we've gotten into their history. Is it back to when Obama was 8 years old? Kane's prisoner of war status. I mean, everything has been vetted. And like you say, if anything does come out that's shocking, I think it would turn negative on the candidate. So I'm pretty sure we're not going to see a whole lot of that coming from either one of these two.
So would you bet the above politics show minuscule budget on the next presidential election as being probably equally as exciting as the last one?
I'd say at least that.
Least as exciting, Ollie. Well, there you are. And guess what? Of course we will. When that debate goes out, we'll have no doubt have commentary, not only from myself and Homer, but we'll also go maybe back out to Don, but we'll also go out to some other members. And this is certainly an invitation to all the community at ATS. If there's something you want to say about the presidential elections, just drop a email, drop a UTU. If you wanted to do a voice recording, all you'd have to do is put it on an MP3 format and email it to either Homer or I, and we can put it into the next show. So there is the opportunity.
And I'd like for the listeners to remember that ours is a unique format. And you're going to get points of view and you're going to get commentary here that you can't get anywhere else. So if they do have these unique comments or something fantastic to present to us, that is what this show's designed.
Absolutely. And moving swiftly on, I have to report that the British government have spent a similar sum to the American government on bailing out the banks. We have invested somewhere, depending on who you talk to, but it's in the region of £300 to £400 billion. It's sort of a similar amount to what the US have invested. So it seems throughout the world, many governments in the sort of first world are sort of coughing up and asking the taxpayers to bail out some financial institutions. And I have to think, yes, should we bail out some of these financial institutions? You know, were we just encouraging big business and some of these very big leaders to say, well, we can afford to take risks, but the government are going to bail us out here?
Well, I think the your figures are only mildly off, but I believe it's up to 500 billion now is the current plan with, you know, because when you're talking about Lloyd's, TSB, and Barclays. But here's the problem. What we talked about at the last show, Martin, is this is a global problem, and we're just now starting to see that with the British bailout, the bailout here in the United States. This is global. This is not something that is going to be centric simply to the United States. And I believe the quote was 20% fall in bank shares over a week's period in Britain. And they're going to have to nationalize the entire sector. And if they don't, I think the results are just devastating. This is coming from a conservative that trusts the market. I trust the market. I truly do. But it's gotten to the point now where someone has to step in, and that's what we're seeing.
But, you know, are we expecting the government to bail in now and save every business? You know, are we going to be looking, and hassling our local representatives to say when, you know, the local building contractor or the local village shop or the local garage or the local tire place goes under? I'm sorry, I just can't see this point. If you believe in the market, you have to accept that if a business has failed to take due care with its risks and has done some incredibly stupid things, and all this has come about with people trying to make money about selling debt.
And I understand your point of view. I think it's hard, but I understand your point of view. However, tell that Granny Smith who's getting ready to lose every bit of her save, or Mr. and Mrs. Jones across the street whose 401k is worth 30 or 40% less than what they planned on for retirement. That's the problem. You were trying to explain these huge market fluctuations to normal people.
And I think that's a, you know, yes, harsh. I would say somewhat harsh, and I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, I think certainly in the UK, retail deposits in the UK, so that's the deposits that you and I and the general public make, should be absolutely protected. I mean, one of the interesting things we've got in the UK, Homer, is a bank based out of Iceland, which, you know, to all intents and purposes, many people are saying Iceland as a country is bankrupt because it's basically just cannot afford to subsidize and bail out its own bank. But there are people in the UK, maybe there are some local authorities, there are some local councils, and there are some charities who are saying, oh, but we've, you know, got millions of pounds tied up in a bank called Icesave out of Iceland that have gone under, and now they're expecting the government to bail them out. And I have to think, sorry, if you're not prepared to invest money in your own country, you were doing this because you were greedy and you wanted to make a few more pounds, a few more dollars on your income. I'm sorry, if you invest in the United Kingdom, and I don't know whether you think the same, if someone invests in the United States and they're a charity or they're a local authority, then I think the government do have an obligation to protect that. But if you're greedy and just go and find the highest interest account in some foreign country, why should I as a taxpayer bail you out when you've just been plainly greedy? And the other one is, where was all the risk assessment of all of this? You know, these are, you know, public authorities, public bodies who are spending my money, and potentially if they're doing this in the States and overseas, your money, yet they just felt it was appropriate to put it into the highest bank, highest interest-bearing bank account. Tough. I don't think you should be bailed out. You should have to live or die by the sword because you were greedy.
I understand what you're saying, and that is certainly a valid point of view. However, you're completely negating the fact of the global economy, and that's what we've got. We have a global economy. People invest in everything. I mean, I have investments that are based overseas, and I just don't know how a government is going to step in, do a bailout, and yet only bail out certain elements of the market that's in trouble. I just don't think you can do that. I don't think you can say we're going to bail out only the British founded institutions and banks like the Icelandic Bank. We're just going to let that be handled by the market. I don't think you can do that. I think that the fallout over something like that would just be, I mean, I can't even imagine the political fallout. And who would pick and choose? Who's going to say, okay, we're going to bail this one out and not this one? Are you going to bail out the Irish investments, the Scottish investments? Where do you draw the line, Martin? That's what I'm saying. Where, at what point do you draw the line, and who is it that makes that determination?
Absolutely, that's a good point. And guess what? If you want to enter into this debate with us, you know what to do. Find the show thread and post away. We see anything, any comments, both Homer and I will be onto it. But that's a very good point. Who does that? Well, ultimately, that's my government. I mean, I think the point I was making with the UK institutions who had invested in Icesave in Iceland was they could have put that money into a UK bank and given capital to a UK bank. They were greedy, decided they wanted to make an extra percent or an extra half a percent, so invested in a foreign bank that maybe doesn't have the same kind of controls and regulations that exist potentially in the UK and in the US. And that's where I'm going with that one is, sorry, you could have invested in the UK. Stocks and shares, I think, is a slightly different thing, and certainly with the 401 plans and UK pensions and pensions throughout the world, they are a slightly different case. But when you're just putting millions of pounds of cash and you're putting it overseas because you want that extra quarter of a percent, when you could leave it in your own country under that banking system, when it all goes wrong, why should you expect me as a taxpayer to bail it out for you?
I understand what you're saying, but also, what if everybody did that, Martin? What if everybody only put their money into their individual country's economic institution? Then you're talking about a further separation of the global economy. You're talking about the United States separating itself from the rest of the world. You're talking about Great Britain separating itself from the rest of the world. And that type of separation just isn't healthy for the market. I mean, the market needs global stability. And I mean, the German government is supposed to, I mean, sometime today they're supposed to talk about, they're putting out 50 billion to 100 billion euros into their banking institution. I mean, every single country that is in this economic foundation, so to speak, is having to step up to the plate. I understand what you're saying, but I just think that Britain and the United States, the numbers are so high because we are so economically based, for lack of a better word.
Guess what? If we have a listener from Iceland, hey, come to us, talk to us about this one, because the interesting thing about this was the diplomatic pressure seems to have been ratcheted up between Iceland and the United Kingdom on this one. And for those of you with a longer memory, and I'm not even sure whether Homer's going to remember this, if I say the Cod Wars, he may just think, what is this crazy Brit on about? But if you're listening in the United Kingdom or you're listening in Iceland and I mention the Cod Wars, I think you're going to nod your head sagely. And for the next show, I will do a little piece on the Cod Wars for you. But coming up, we have a quick break, and then following that, we'll do a quick segment with the UK Roundup.
Hi everyone, Dave Rabbit here with the ATS Mix Show from AboveTopSecret.com. My partner, Johnny Anonymous, and I would like to extend a personal invitation to all of our members and guests to attend this year's Culture of Contact UFO Festival, being held in Jersey City, New Jersey, this October 16th, 17th, and 18th of 2008. It is the only event of its kind run by alien abductees and experiencers. There will be huge names in the field that are going to be there, and most of them will be stripped of their PowerPoint presentations, and it will just be you, the speaker, and a microphone. Special guests include Bill Burns from UFO Hunters, Richard Dolan, Steve Bassett, Peter Robbins, Michael Mannion, Dave Bidney, Jeff Ritzman, and others. Plus, there's a rumor that there might be a special guest or two that just might show up. This year's theme is Mythology is Reality. The keynote speaker, T.O. Kassen Ghost Horse. And he will take us to the heart of what that means. So come on out. ATS will be there. Mark Allen will be there. An event like this doesn't happen but once in a lifetime, and unlike normal UFO conferences, this one will not break your bank account. For all the details and ticket information, please check out their website at www.cultureofcontact.com. That's www.cultureofcontact.com. Don't miss this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to rub shoulders with some of the best.
Hi guys, this is Neff with a roundup of the main UK political talking points this week. It's all been about Gordon Brown and the Labour Party over the past 7 days. Brown has decided to undertake a ministerial reshuffle in order to, in his words, reinvent government to try and cope with the new challenges of financial uncertainty and rising food and oil prices. Or, in my words, to try and quell some of the uprising within the Labour Party. The changes see the introduction of 3 new people into post, with 4 dropping out and 7 moving. By far the most interesting of the new appointments is that of the new Business Secretary, a slot that is being filled by one Peter Mandelson, better known to UK listeners as the Prince of Darkness, a man who is renowned for his habit of spinning opinions and facts to suit his needs and, in previous ministerial incarnations, has had to resign twice from the Blair government. The first time after receiving an undeclared loan when he was Trade Secretary, and the second time for his handling and attempted influence of a situation regarding manipulation of a passport application when he was Northern Ireland Secretary. The move is made even harder to understand when you take into consideration that Brown and Mandelson have a genuine dislike for each other stretching back as far as 2004. Brown's thinking seems to be along the lines that, as Mandelson was EU Trade Commissioner for the previous 4 years, he has a good grasp of the financial workings of the European economy, which will be necessary in these uncertain times. We'd best hope that things pick up sharply then, as my experience suggests Mr. Mandelson won't have long in office before another skeleton comes rattling out of the cupboard and history will be repeating itself. That's all from me this week. Back to you guys in the studio.
And I'm talking with Paul Harrod, who is the prospective MP for the Liberal Democrats for Bristol and the North West in the United Kingdom. Thank you very much, Paul. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today.
Yep, good afternoon. Nice to speak to you.
And I suppose one of the first things would be maybe to just give some of our listeners who will be throughout the world, so may not understand the three-party system in the United Kingdom, if I could get you to give us a quick overview of the Liberal Democrats, and if you can do it, a little bit of a history.
Sure. Well, I mean, the Liberal Democrats are the successor party to the Great Liberal Party, which basically dominated politics in the 19th century in Britain. Your listeners may have heard of Gladstone. They may have heard of Lord John Russell. They may have heard of people like J.S. Mill, who wrote on liberty, and then some of the great reformers of the late 20th century, Asquith and Lloyd George, who, of course, successfully were both prime ministers in the lead-up and then during the First World War. People like Bentham, the founders of the modern welfare state, is a great reforming liberal tradition. Clearly, we haven't been in government for a few years, for much of the 20th century, but I think the party is certainly back on the up in the UK under the new leadership of Nick Clegg.
And I think that's certainly something that I've seen. We asked our listeners for some questions, and I certainly think a couple of them were asking questions about, you know, what does the Liberal Democratic Party have to do to sort of take the leap from, you know, at the last elections having its best ever result in the biggest number of MPs for a great many years, to taking that big leap to becoming the next, you know, government?
Well, I think it's starting already at local government. I mean, actually, we have more councillors than the Labour Party does. So actually at local government level, it's the Liberal Democrats, which are the second party, and actually the governing party of the United Kingdom, Labour, are actually down in third. And the most recent local elections, again, we pushed them into third place. So a lot of cities, Bristol, which is obviously where I hope to be one of the MPs for, the Liberal Democrats, the largest party in Bristol. We control Liverpool, we control Sheffield, and the big city councils. So I do think we're certainly on the up, and often the local government base is where you then use as a springboard to parliamentary and national base. Now, clearly, the UK electoral system is one that isn't really fair to a third party. We got 22% of the vote at the last general election, only 9% of the MPs. So clearly, within the system, we have our work cut out. But we've gained MPs every single general election since 1992, and there's no reason why we shouldn't be looking to double the number of MPs we've got over the next two parliaments.
And if you're thinking of, so if we sort of take that doubling, where do you see that coming from? Are you seeing that coming from disaffected Labour supporters or disaffected Tory supporters?
Well, I think there'll be a lot of positive votes for the Liberal Democrats. I mean, a very interesting fact is, I mean, occasionally the odd media commentator will claim we're going to lose a lot of MPs in the next general election. I don't believe that's true at all. Because actually where people have Liberal Democrat MPs, they know that they work hard for them, they represent them well, they do a huge amount of work in the community. They're very, very popular. And so actually once Lib Dem MPs were elected, they're very hard to remove, and quite rightly so. So I think we've got a very good, solid base. I think clearly we'll pick up a lot of MPs at the next election from Labour, because you know, despite David Cameron's success, I mean, a lot of the north of England is still a no-go zone for the Conservative Party. They've got a single councillor in places like Manchester and Newcastle, I mean, big cities. So I think the Lib Dems are going to win some MPs there. I'm in Bristol North West. I'm up against, well, actually, our seat is a redrawn seat. So it's half Liberal Democrat and half Labour. So I'm you know, rather hopeful I'll be successful at the next general election. But actually, it's not the case that we're going to lose out to the Conservatives either. In large parts of the south of England, where we've had local council elections, and we've done very, very well against them. So often when it's a very clear two-horse race, it's clear that the Liberal Democrats can win, then we do win. I think our problem is because the media is so clearly focused on Labour, Conservative, Labour, a lot of the public don't realise what a force we are. So we can get our message across, our positive message, and show that we can win, then we tend to do very, very well indeed.
And certainly I think that's an interesting thing for our North American listeners, in the fact that, you know, the US political scene is very dominated by just two parties.
Yes.
But I suppose one of the interesting things is, would, if, for example, the doomsday scenario comes up and potentially there is a hung parliament, the definition of a hung parliament for the listeners would be that no one party has an absolute majority, do you think that the Liberal Democrats would entertain any offers from either the Labour Party or the Conservative Party to form a coalition government, which, other than sort of in times of war, is typically not something we do in the UK?
Well, it's funny you should say it's a doomsday scenario. I think it actually be a very positive thing, because what you would have then is government better reflecting the national interest. What we've got in this country is effectively a elected dictatorship. I mean, the last general election, Labour got, I think, 36% of the vote, and yet have a very sizable working majority. Now, in the past, you wouldn't have got things like the poll tax through. You wouldn't have got, actually, the votes to authorise the war in Iraq through the House of Parliament if, actually, you had a House of Commons that reflected the votes of the people cast. So actually, I think a balanced parliament where there is no dominant party that can simply push things through, regardless of public opinion or regardless of other parties' view of the matter, really wouldn't be a bad thing at all. Now, we're often asked about what would happen in the basis of a balanced parliament. Now, there's absolutely no question we would certainly not be propping up a fading Labour government, which has got less MPs than the Conservative Party has. But nor would we ever join with David Cameron in pushing through, for example, tax rises to pay for his inheritance tax cuts for millionaires, or to repeal the Human Rights Act, or to their idea of further deregulating the mortgage market, which is an absolutely insane idea after what's happened over the last few weeks. What we would do is we would support whatever government was in power, where we thought the policy they were putting through were the best interests of the country. In Scotland, your listeners may be interested to know, actually the Liberal Democrats were in coalition in Scotland, and we got things through such as free long-term personal care for elderly people, no tuition fees for Scottish university students. So often our policies have been implemented. And so I think whichever was the largest party, we would support them and doing the right thing, but we'd strongly oppose them if they were doing the wrong thing. So actually your listeners who can vote in the UK, your UK listeners, if they value what Liberal Democrats stand for, then they should vote for us at the next general election. Because the more MPs we have, the more chance we've got of getting our programme and our policies implemented.
And clearly one of the things that comes off that was, would you either personally, and then what would be the Liberal Democrat stance on this one, to be any change in the electoral system?
Well, our system, electoral system is broken. I mean, it's absolutely the case. I mean, the last general election, more people stayed at home and didn't vote than voted for the Labour Party. You know, I mentioned before that we got 22% of the vote and only 9% of the MP. So, you know, what people vote for isn't what they get. But equally, we wouldn't be arrogant enough to suggest that, well, you know, here's an electoral system, do it our way. I mean, we'd have to have a referendum on it. And, of course, we would abide by the result. But I think if you put the central issue of how can you better get people making their votes count, I think they would enjoy overwhelming public support. And what we have in the UK actually is quite similar to America, because in the American election, let's face it, we know Texas will vote Republican, we know California will vote Democrat. So there's very little point in casting your vote in those huge states, because the result is determined. So what you get is Obama and McCain targeting all their resources, millions upon millions of pounds, on swing voters in swing states, or actually more likely swing voters in swing districts in swing states. And general elections are decided on very small numbers of people. We have the same thing with our system, where if you're a conservative voter in Manchester or Newcastle or parts of Bristol, there's no point. You know, you're not going to win. Equally, probably a Liberal Democrat vote in, I don't know, deepest, darkest Tunbridge Wells, again, your vote doesn't count. So a system which better represents all votes but still will retain some sort of constituency link, I think will reinvigorate politics. And that, you know, it's far more about making sure votes count that will drive up turnout, not Sunday voting or voting in supermarkets or whatever. It's simply a fair electoral system. So you're absolutely right. I mean, we are completely clear that we want electoral reform, but clearly we will put that to the British people and, an informed debate on what the best solution would be.
But I suppose one of the issues you have is to my mind, I see this, Paul, as a chicken and egg here, is typically I can't see currently either the Labour Party or the Conservative Party wanting to change the electoral system, because they gain advantage from it.
Well, I think they get some advantage in the sense that it's generally Buggins' term. You know, Conservatives fail, Labour takes over, Labour fails, Conservatives takes over. So yes, you're right, they do have an advantage in that they're probably, you know, the last 100 years, probably in power one out of every two times. But I think there's increasingly a recognition that our politics is broken. I think the very stark fact that, say, more people stayed at home than actually voted for the government is something we simply can't continue with. And certainly if there was a balanced parliament and, the Liberal Democrats vote became absolutely crucial, we will continue to argue for a referendum on electoral reform. And clearly the more MPs we have, the better the chance of that happening.
Okay. And one of the things that would be useful is, what do you see that separates a Liberal Democrat from a Conservative and a Liberal Party? What are the sort of main themes that you want to go out to the people of the United Kingdom and say, this is why we are different from the Conservative, this is why we are different from Labour?
Okay, well, let's take Labour first. I think, one sense, I think both the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrat Party is, believe in social justice, and, want a fairer, more equal society. But part of the problem with Labour is I think they've got an incredibly centralised, top-down approach. They don't trust in people. It's micromanaging from what I talk, initiatives after initiative, target after target. And they pretty much wrap this country up in bureaucracy and red tape and giving teachers and doctors and managers very little scope to innovate and be free. We believe in local government and empowering local communities. They seem to like to emasculate local government and run everything from the centre. We've had major issues over civil liberties, and we are implacable opponents of ID cards. I mean, the fact that we're going to be spending £6 billion on compulsory ID cards rather than, for example, putting more police out on the streets is a fundamental dividing line. And clearly the war in Iraq was a major issue where thousands upon thousands of former Labour voters came out of Liberal Democrats because we were the party that opposed on principle the invasion of Iraq right from the start when the Labour and Conservative parties, happily joined together to vote that through. With the Conservative Party, I mean, the Liberal Democrats have always championed the environment, and we've made tough decisions about what we would do to reduce carbon emissions. Really, the Tory Party's got little track record that they care about it. I don't think, despite the posturing, that they have a vision for a fairer society. I mean, at the time of probably the worst financial crisis we've had in this country, and indeed across the world since the Wall Street crash of 1929, why the Conservative Party's only tax policy is to reduce inheritance tax for millionaires. I mean, beggar's belief. We've got a situation in this country where people who work in private equity and investment banking pay a lower rate of tax than the people that clean their offices. I mean, how is that just? How is that fair? And yet the Conservative Party would actually say, well, actually, let's reduce inheritance tax for those millionaires rather than looking at bringing people out of paying tax altogether, reducing inequality, reducing the income divide. So you've got some fairly fundamental differences between us. And I think ultimately the Liberal Democrats, but I mentioned this history, we've got this rich heritage going back to Mill and Gladstone and Lloyd George and Churchill in the early part of his career. We are a coherent party. Our policies are voted on by our membership, so I think they're far more robust than you get from the leader-led policy diktats of the other parties. I think we are the choice for those that want a greener, fairer and safer Britain.
Okay, and I certainly know you've recently had your conference,
yes.
And I think it would be fair to say it was sort of seen as a fair success, other than a faux pas with your leader not knowing what the basic pension for a single person and a married person was.
Yes, I think he did about 15 interviews in a row. He's probably a bit tired. Although, actually, it is an interesting point. Would you rather have a leader who perhaps didn't quite get the precise amount of what pensioners get but wants to pay them more, or the Prime Minister who knows precisely what pensioners get and has got no interest in giving them more? I mean, the point is, we've got a policy of restoring the earnings link between pensions and average earnings, which of course was abolished under Margaret Thatcher. So you're seeing pensioners' average incomes compared to the rest of the population falling and falling and falling, which is why we've now got the scandalous situation of many pensioners facing a choice between, paying their bills and heating their homes. I mean, it's a disgrace. So, yes, it was a mistake. Nick held his hand up and said, I made a mistake, but our policies on what we would do to address pension poverty are very clear and very robust.
And I think it is sort of interesting that's sort of probably one of the big highlights that came out of the conference was Nick Clegg maybe not knowing that. And I'm sure you would say there are many other more important things that were discussed and spoken about at that conference that you wish the electorate were probably more informed about.
Yeah. I mean, it's why I'm proud of speaking quite candidly to you. I mean, I enjoy the fact that this is quite a rare thing actually for a politician to have a discussion such as this, because very often it is about personalities and, you know, the gaffe you make. And I have sympathy for everybody. I have sympathy for David Cameron and Gordon Brown as well, and also, you know, Obama and McCain and Palin and Joe Biden. I mean, you know, any small mistake you make, any slight tripping up of your words, and you're jumped upon. And I think it's a shame. I mean, you know, that's A, the media does this, but perhaps also other politicians don't do themselves a favour by pointing other mistakes out by their opponents. If we accept that everybody makes a mistake and perhaps, you know, saved our fire for when it's clearly a strategic error or it's a really an outrageous comment, we'd all do better. So, yeah, I mean, everyone knows Nick Clegg knows what pensions are paid. I mean, you know, why beat him up about it? And perhaps equally we should give Gordon Brown and David Cameron a bit more latitude if they make the occasional verbal slip-up.
And I think you're absolutely right there. And certainly one of the things which I know you did see was we put a thread up sort of announcing this interview, and we did have one of our forum moderators, Nephemore, ask a question. And I think it's an interesting question. And his question was, how long would it take for Vince Cable to become leader after the next general election? And I think that's certainly something that a lot of people are interested in the fact that, you know, Nick Clegg is the leader now. But I get the impression that some of the commentators felt that Vince Cable came out of the Lib Dem conference very well.
He certainly did. I mean, I think actually Vince's reputation has soared in recent months because, you know, as a regular Liberal Democrat conference attendee, I mean, Vince has been speaking for years about the potential impact of the credit crunch, the over-indebtedness of British society, the irresponsible lending of UK banks. By the way, when John Redwood, the Conservative Party, said greater deregulation, can you believe it? Greater deregulation of the mortgage industry. David Cameron said that's a great idea. So I think effectively Vince has been proved right, just quite simply. You know, he was right on Northern Rock and everything since. You know, as the former chief economist for Shell, which for, you know, is practically the UK's largest company, he's clearly a towering figure and a real heavyweight. And if you compare him to George Osborne, who's done nothing outside of politics in his life, I'd be interested to know from your listeners who they think would make the better chancellor, Vince Cable or George Osborne. But actually, the point is Vince didn't stand for the leader because he didn't want to do the job. He supports Nick. They're actually a great team. And you know, and I'll give you my honest view, is I think Vince is in the right job. I think he's absolutely cut out to be Shadow Chancellor and indeed Chancellor of the Exchequer. He's the finest financial brain in the House of Commons on any side of the House. And I think his skills are ideally suited to be Chancellor. And I think Nick Clegg is a very promising leader. He's a fantastic communicator. And I will put a lot of money, my own money, on the fact that come the general election, when actually the media does, you know, by law, give the Liberal Democrats fair and equal coverage, that his reputation, his profile in the country will soar, because I think he's a very substantial figure and, as I say, the best communication politics I've come across.
Certainly, just I've got a couple of issues that I've just typically always ask people. Where does the Liberal Democrats, or where do the Liberal Democrats stand on the UK's membership of the European Union? And where do you stand on the euro potentially being a currency in the United Kingdom?
Well, we've always been a you know, prominent and passionate pro-European party. I mean, I think it's ludicrous to think in the current day and age you can't tackle issues such as climate change, such as the security of energy supply, international terrorism, without a concerted and cooperative approach at the European level. So, I mean, and I've got no problems with that. I mean, it's a trading bloc, and I think there are a lot of things we can work together on, as I mentioned, that those three issues, which you know, we need to do more of. And unfortunately, I think this government under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, our reputation in Europe has arguably gone down from even that under John Major and Margaret Thatcher. I think we've also said that, in principle, we're in favour of joining the euro when the time's right, but clearly the time isn't right. And actually, I do think it needs to be when it's in our economic interests that we would do so. And actually, at no point in the euro's history has it looked remotely like it is in our economic interests. So we're certainly not ruling it out, but it's way off the agenda at the moment. It's not something I expect to see, for years to come, if at all.
Okay, well, certainly the, sort of as we're getting close to the end of the interview, one of the things I did see was a sort of change in the policies of the Liberal Democrats in that they were talking about tax cuts, which I think,
yes.
If you were a serious, studier of politics in the United Kingdom, is probably something you wouldn't necessarily associate with the Liberal Democrats here. So I just wonder, what's the sort of rationale behind sort of now talking the magic tax cuts?
I think it's very simple. I mean, many of your listeners may know, back in the 1990s, we argued for an increase in the basic rate of income tax to pay for education and to pay for health, because they were scandalously underinvested under the Thatcher and major governments. But times have changed, and actually what we've now got is that the spending tap's been turned on to such an extent under Blair and Brown, and actually we're now seeing huge amounts of waste. And actually what we are getting is an increasing income divide. I mentioned before, it is a fact that because the wealthiest people can declare their income as capital, they pay a lower rate of tax than the people that clean their offices. So what our tax cuts are firmly and squarely focused on is cutting tax for the lowest earners and middle income earners, and paying for that by closing down some of the tax loopholes exploited by the runaway rich, and also looking at ways in which we can properly cost the environmental impacts of polluting activities. Actually, from my understanding, Barack Obama's got very similar policies. It's I think the sort of conservative approach is quite similar to John McCain's, which is, as Nick Clegg said in his conference, it's trickle-down economics. Well, ordinary people don't deserve to be trickled on, I think was Nick Clegg's phrase. We would look to take the lowest earners out of paying tax altogether, reducing the tax burden on working people, and a proper and fair contribution from, as I say, those that are, the very wealthiest in society. Now, I don't see that's perfectly consistent with our core message and core principles of social justice. And I think it's actually a bit of a scandal that actually after 10-plus years of Labour government, they simply allowed this to happen, and they've never had the courage to properly tackle this. And so the Conservative Party is quite clear. Their priorities are cutting inheritance tax for the wealthiest 6% of people in this country. So, it's chalk and cheese. It's a very, very clear dividing line. And I think it'll play very well for us the general election, because I think actually the public is behind us on this issue.
Okay, and I've got, from my point of view, one final question would be, where would you stand on a local income tax or community charge in the UK?
Well, our policy is very clear again on that. We think council tax is an unfair tax. For example, a single pensioner living on their own in their house, very often that they're paying the same rate of council tax as perhaps the next door house with three or four young professionals or house sharing. So we've made clear that we favour a local income tax. It's a tax based on the ability to pay. For people earning over £70,000 a year, which, forgive my math, is probably about $140,000 a year, yes, they will pay a small amount more tax. But for everybody else earning under that, which is the majority of people in this country, they would pay less, or they pay the same as they currently do. Also, the principle of local income tax means that you can have greater accountability. So actually your local councils, if they're choosing to invest in a new bus service or a new infrastructure or to increase levels of recycling, could make their case for why they want additional funding. I think it's a much more accountable and democratic way of funding local services. And again, if you'll forgive the political point, the Conservative Party talks about freezing council tax, which I think is a disastrous policy, because A, it's entrenching an unfair, regressive tax, but also if they're simply freezing it with no way of replacing the income, all you'd see under a David Cameron government is big cuts in local services. I don't think people in this country want that.
Okay, well, I certainly want to thank you for your time. If people want to know more about you or the Liberal Democrats, is there a website that they can go to?
It certainly is. Our national website, which I certainly would recommend you look at, is www.libdems.org.uk. And, people can email me. It's paul@paulharrod.org.uk.
And I will make sure, dear listeners, that both of those websites are put on the show thread. Well, I want to thank you very much, Paul. I certainly hope that if maybe in the future we could come to you for another interview.
Certainly. Happy to, yeah.
And certainly if you were to become MP, I'd like to think I might be on your list of people you would talk to.
Always, Martin. Okay. Thank you very much. Enjoy.
Okay, thank you very much.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Hello, everyone. This is Homer Fife. I'm a little confused, so bear with me here. How is it that all of you hard-working Americans, one and all, can support a candidate that openly states he is going to raise taxes? Yes, this is a rant on taxes. Now, don't tell me that all of you fall for that sad, tired old line that he's only going to raise taxes on the rich or on corporations or, more exactly what he stated, on those making $250,000 or more per year. Read the tax code, people. Obama's tax increase will hit every single person in the United States making over $42,000 a year. That's right, every single person. And that's just the beginning. Taxing corporations has been proven time and again to directly impact the labor pool, costing us jobs and reducing the overall intake of the government coffers. Facts, people, facts. These corporations are the heartbeat of this country. And while some of us are going through some economic difficulties right now, it may seem like the thing to do to beat up on the big bad corporations. Who do we all work for? Now, why, you may ask, is taxing corporations a bad idea? Simple. If a corporation is required to pay the government a higher percentage of their net gains, that corporation will do any one of several things to ensure the life of their corporation and their continued profit margin. They are either going to cut the workforce or increase the cost of that product or service that they offer, or both. Now, why is it that all of you out there that support the Democratic Party just can't quite get your minds around this? Most major corporations in the market have been making the same percentage of profit for the life of the corporate body. An example would be ExxonMobil at 8%. A tax increase is not going to cause them to change that. And guess what? This is not quite a socialist society yet, and they can't be forced to change it. Now, when you combine this kind of a boneheaded move with another ridiculous move, an increased spending package, what you have is a recipe for complete disaster. 2 years ago, we elected a democratically controlled House and Senate. I told everyone then that you're going to get what you asked for. Well, you got it. In 2 short years, the Democrats have managed to destroy the economy, to increase spending, to cost us jobs, to generally ruin a strong economy in every way. Think about it, people. Who can gain the most and continues to gain from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Look it up, people. Look it up. The Democrats were in charge of that. What kind of change does Obama offer? Just more of the same. This is Homer Fife. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics Show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.